Welcome. This is one in a series of the Interpreter Roundtables. My name is Martin Tanner. I'll be moderating. With me is Bruce Webster. Today we are covering Gospel Doctrine Lesson 33 from the Book of Mormon, the title of which is A Sure Foundation. The purpose of this lesson is to encourage class members to build their testimonies on the foundation of Jesus Christ. There's some wonderful material here. We're covering Helaman chapters 1 through 5 to give us a background about where in the Book of Mormon we are, so we have some context for our lesson today. We'll turn the time over to Bruce.
These chapters cover roughly a 20-year period from about 50 BC to about 30 BC. And this is, for me, whenever I read the Book of Mormon, this is sort of the start of the cresting over the hill and the steady falling apart of Nephi society that's going to occur from now up until the time of the Savior's death, roughly 80 years from Helaman 1. We see the factors that are happening, and these five chapters sort of illustrate the constant up and down nature of Nephite society and some of the fragmentation that's going on both among the Nephites and among the Lamanites. And with that in mind, I think it's why the lesson theme of a sure foundation is important, because what you see through this is that the only safety comes in being built upon the foundation of Christ, our Redeemer, as Helaman told his sons Lehi and Nephi. The Helaman of the Book of Helaman here is Helaman, the son of Helaman, who was the son of Alma, who's the son of Alma. We'll dive into it. Before we get into the chapters, there's one important verse, and this is echoed elsewhere in the Book of Mormon, but this is so important because there are a lot of members who tend to go for a very tight reading of the Book of Mormon. And by tight, I mean saying, if it's not described in the Book of Mormon, it didn't happen. In fact, I saw a discussion of that online not a month or two ago, where someone was basically saying, you know, the Book of Mormon never explicitly says there were other people, therefore there was no other people there in the Americas when Lehi's party arrived, which is silly on any number of levels, up to including the fact that a careful reading of the Book of Mormon makes it clear that there were indigenous populations. But if we go to Helaman chapter 3, verses 13 through 15, this is, and I assume this is probably, I don't know if this is Helaman writing in his record or if this is Mormon making commentary. Oh, this is Mormon. I'm sorry. This is definitely Mormon, because he goes on to say, it's my, you know, here's where, how things are in my time. But verse 14 in particular, he says, "Behold, a hundredth part of the proceedings of this people, yea, the account of the Lamanites and of the Nephites and their wars and contentions and dissensions and their preaching and their prophecies and their shipping and their building of ships and their building of temples and of synagogues and their sanctuaries and their righteousness and their wickedness and their murders and their plunderings and all manner of abominations and whoredoms cannot be contained in this work." What Mormon put together was a very careful and select abridgment. There is a lot going on here that we do not have records of. There's a lot that can be derived or guessed at, you know, carefully read the Book of Mormon. But it's important to realize we're getting a very, very selective and purpose-driven history here. We're not getting a comprehensive history. So to take the attitude of, well, you know, they never talk about the big culture center in the north in Tuatha Clan. There are strong suggestions that, yes, this is actually a major influence for the Book of Mormon, but it's indirect, and it's applying archaeology to the Book of Mormon record. The point is that there's a lot more going on than we know about. And Mormon's purpose in writing was to warn us in our day what we need to do and not to do. And that's the purpose of these chapters, among others. So with that, I'll go into Helaman 1 and I'll turn it back to Martin.
These are fabulous chapters. And before we jump right into them, I'll echo what Bruce said. If you take a work that ostensibly covers from 600 to BC to approximately 400 AD, or you're looking at a 1,000-year period, there is no way that you could even cover anywhere close to comprehensively just the spiritual matters of the people for 1,000 years. That would average approximately a page for every other year. You know, you wouldn't even devote a page when you get right down to it. This is certainly an abridgment, as is mentioned many, many times, which brings to mind Cliff Notes and all kinds of other things. And the Book of Mormon is certainly not Cliff Notes, but it is very definitely an abbreviated form of what the final record was. You know, another example might be if one were to take a look at the Joseph Smith history, which is a multi-volume work and is in fact much longer than the Book of Mormon, but it only covers Joseph Smith's lifetime. And for people who know a little bit about his lifetime and have read many source documents about him, you would find out that even in the multi-volume official Joseph Smith history, there are all kinds of things in his life that never made it into that history. And so the Bible got it right when it was talking about Jesus and said that all the books in the world couldn't contain what Jesus said and did. And I also echo the statement that Bruce made about just because the Book of Mormon doesn't mention something doesn't mean it didn't happen. We have to use our logic here. If there are more than 1,500 known Native American dialects in North and South America, it would be foolish to think that somehow they all derived from the Book of Mormon peoples in the last 1,400, 1,500 years or so. It's impossible. It's absolutely impossible. So the facts would preclude some kind of comment like that. Okay, down to the Book of Helaman itself. The Book of Helaman starts out with murder, intrigue, and secret pacts. Pahoran, the second, becomes chief judge and is murdered by Kishkumen. And so what happens here, there is this pact made to make sure that what's happened doesn't come out. And let's go over some of the basic things here. Verse 5, after there were three divisions amongst the people, verse 5 says, "Nevertheless, it came to pass that Pahoran was appointed by the voice of the people to be chief judge and a governor over the people of Nephi. And it came to pass that Bakumani, when he saw that he could not obtain the judgment seat, he did unite with the voice of the people. And Pianki, behold, Pianki and the part of the people that were desirous that he should be their governor were exceedingly wroth." And so you have problems. Different people want different leaders. And then you have in verse 9 a statement that when those people who were desirous that he should be their governor saw that he was condemned unto death, therefore they were angry, and behold, they sent forth one Kishkumen even to the judgment seat of Pahoran, and murdered Pahoran as he sat upon the judgment seat. And he's pursued. Verse 11 says that he went unto those that sent him, and they all entered into a covenant, yea, swearing by their everlasting maker that they would tell no man that Kishkumen had murdered Pahoran. Now, I have thought about that verse many times and wondered, how is it that they could swear to their maker that they would tell no man? Did they really think they were doing something good, and so they were willing to swear to God? Or was this sort of a false oath? This is just a really kind of a bizarre oath, but it did serve its purpose. I mean, the point was to make those people who knew about this plot to say nothing. And this causes huge, huge problems. Pekumenai fills the judgment seat. Coriantumr leads the Lamanite armies and takes Zarahemla and slays Pekumenai. And then you have more and more battles. So it's this tragic cycle of evil, and we're into the part of the Book of Mormon where in many places you don't so much have the good guys and the bad guys, you have the bad guys and the worst guys, or maybe two sets of bad guys. It's at a point where it's kind of tragic, to say the least. Back to you, Bruce.
A couple of points on the second half of the chapter here. Once again, as we had much through the war chapters back in Alma, you've got the Lamanites coming down to attack the Nephites, but they're being led by Nephite dissenters. You have Tubaloth, who is the son of Amoron, who is a Nephite dissenter, who's king of the Lamanites. So the Lamanites are being led by Nephite dissenters, and Coriantumr is a descendant of Zarahemla, meaning he's of Mulekite descent. And what I find fascinating about the attack here, I've as I mentioned before, I've read a lot of military history. I've played a fair number of war games. This is a classic pattern. In essence, the attacking force, rather than skirmishing with the outlying borders, goes straight for the heart of the territory. And they're not expecting a direct attack on the capital city of Zarahemla. And it falls. You have, he basically marches in so fast that Moroni Ha, son of Moroni, and Lehi can't get assembled in time to do it. But this is a classic military mistake, which is you plunge deep into the enemy territory, and before you realize it, you're actually surrounded. And that's the mistake that Coriantumr does. He goes straight into the center of the land. He captures the capital city and then suddenly realizes he's surrounded by Nephite armies and now all the outlying cities and borders. He tries to cut his way back. He's trying to push forward. I take that back. Part of the theme we're going to see time and again, and this started towards the end of Alma, is the lands north. The Nephites are working very hard to keep the Lamanites from getting a foothold. The Bountiful, the land desolation. Part of it is because they don't want to be surrounded. And I think part of it is they don't want the Lamanites up there taking advantage of this big cultural center, Teotihuacan, which is up in where Mexico City is now. It's a well-established and probably multi-ethnic civilization up there, and you've had a lot of Nephites going to settle in the north country, basically forming a buffer between Bountiful and whatever is to the north, and their concern is that the Lamanites are going to get up there and probably forge other alliances and come down and wipe out the Nephites. So you saw time and again through Alma battles to keep the Lamanites from getting to Bountiful and beyond, and you're having the same thing here. Coriantumr is trying to fight his way to Bountiful, but he's made the classic mistake. He's surrounded. And he's killed. The army's defeated. Ronai-Ha basically sends the Lamanites, and I think this is it. This is indicative that the fight here is really among Nephites. It's Nephite dissenters versus the Nephite civilization. Moroni-Ha basically sends the Lamanites home. He conquers the army and he tells the actual troops, go home. You know, we don't want to fight with you. And that ends the 40 and first year and ends chapter 1.
Chapter two is a fascinating one. Here, Helaman II becomes the chief judge. Gadianton leads the band of Kishkumen. Helaman's servant then slays Kishkumen, and the Gadianton band flees off into the wilderness. So here we have, in verse 4 of chapter 2, the first mention of Gadianton. And the description of him does not bode well for the future. It's not a flattering comment. Verse 4, for there was one Gadianton who was exceedingly expert in many words and also in his craft to carry on the secret work of murder and of robbery. Therefore, he became the leader of the band of Kishkumen. Therefore, he did flatter them and also Kishkumen, that if they would place him in the judgment seat, he would grant unto those who belonged to his band, they should be placed in power and authority along or among the people. Therefore, Kishkumen sought to destroy Helaman. Why? He wanted power. That is the ultimate goal. Now, the next verse, to me, is really quite, the next two verses are kind of fascinating. He goes out. He tries to destroy Helaman. And it says, behold, one of the servants of Helaman, having been out by night, and having obtained through disguise a knowledge of those plans which had been laid by his band to destroy Helaman, and it came to pass that he met Kishkumen and gave unto him a sign. Therefore, Kishkumen made known unto him the object of his desire. And he talks about this intent to murder Helaman. Now, since the very beginning of the time the Book of Mormon was produced, there are a number of people who have made the comments that this idea of giving a sign and this idea of disguise just really wouldn't work. And I ask you to step back a bit, because today we have something different from the old and tired idea of pointing towards different ancient groups to talk about signs and disguises and things. And right now, I'd like to focus on the present. Because today we have gangs in a lot of big cities, and they're running rampant. And if you want to infiltrate a gang, you go in by disguise. You don't go in because you put on a fake mustache and you don't, you know, spray your hair purple. What do you do? There are gang clothes and there are gang signs. And you can see them painted, sadly, all over the place in a lot of different big cities. And that's the way that this infiltration was done. And it makes perfect sense. And we have a modern example that was not around during the time of Joseph Smith. And we don't have to somehow say, oh, this was borrowed from the Masons and this is the sign, and it doesn't make any sense. This makes perfect sense. And this is the very kind of a thing that in today's context, we can now see as very, very plausible. So with that little stop, I wanted to make only one or two more quick comments about chapter two, which isn't too long. So what has happened here? He's found out about it. He reports, and verse 8 is instructive. It says, and when the servant of Helaman had known all the heart of Kishkumen and how that it was his object to murder, and also that it was the object of all those who belonged to his band to murder and to rob to gain power, and this was their secret plan and their combination, the servant of Helaman said to Kishkumen, let us go forth unto the judgment seat. So he's playing along here. And he's able to gain confidence because he's dressed right and he uses these signs to go in. And with that, I'll turn it back to you, Bruce.
Well, and the end is that basically the servant leads Kishkumen sort of closer to the judgment seat, I think to get into safer ground where she's protected, kills Kishkumen. This is a very, very interesting phrase. It says, stabbed him even to the heart that he fell dead without a groan. it's like, ooh, you know, basically slipped a knife up, you know, into his heart from behind or something. Then runs and tells Helaman, and Helaman tries to use the information to capture the gang, but Gaddy Anton is spooked when there's no report back that Helaman's been assassinated, and takes flight into the wilderness. And Mormon ends his abridgment here with a bit of foreshadowing, saying that at the end of this book, and he's talking about the book of Nephi, not the book of Helaman, we shall see that the Gaddi Anton did prove the overthrow, yea, almost the entire destruction of the people of Nephi. So some you get a sense of Mormon's editorial slant here and what he's driving towards. Chapter three is sort of a break here. It covers about 10 years. And you see, once again, this is sort of an upcycle. You see disbursement, large numbers of people who depart from Zarahemla and go forth to the land northward. There's an interesting comment about them being exceedingly expert in the working of cement, something that no one really knew in at Joseph Smith's time, except possibly some Spaniard scholars. But it turns out that specifically in the land northward, which is again this Mexico City basin and south, they had outstanding cement. Many of the buildings there were built with cement. There's no way Joseph Smith could have known this. It's just another one of those bullseyes. And you have this growth. This is where the comment, of course, is made about not a hundredth part is here. And you have contentions, and you have prosperity, and you have, you know, the church growing mightily, and then you have, you know, some pride going, and others who are very humble, and in essence, it's a time of a lot of growth and expansion. The church is doing well, but the church is dealing with issues. Ditto for Nephite society at large. And it ends with Helaman dying and his eldest son Nephi beginning to reign in his stead. So he's in the judge. So now we have Helaman and his son Nephi, both serving as chief judges and doing so in righteousness. Any comments on chapter 3?
Yes, a few comments on chapter 3. Verse 6 is interesting. It says, first of all, the land here is called desolation. But verse 6 tells us that, well, really, when you get right down to it, no part of the land is desolate, except there's no timber there. But it's called desolation because of the great destruction of the people who had been there before. And so here you have a sense of the meaning of the word. It doesn't look like the Sahara Desert. It doesn't look like one of the most desolate places in Nevada or Death Valley or something. It just doesn't have timber that's available to build things. And because it has no timber, it's still a suitable place to live. You just can't build houses out of it. And Bruce mentioned in verse 9 that it talks about houses made out of cement. I wanted to elaborate on that a little bit. Joseph Smith, as Bruce said, could not possibly have known this, since I better not toss out an exact date, but since for more than 60 years now, Catholic University and Harvard University and Brigham Young University have done, from time to time anyway, joint excavations at a site on the just west and north of the Yucatan Peninsula called El Mirador, which was a city made almost entirely out of cement. There were some places where some of the lower buildings were made out of rocks. But El Mirador was a cement city. And some of the dwellings that were there were more than 5 stories high. And this is the kind of thing that Bruce used the word bullseye. That's exactly right. Joseph Smith couldn't possibly have known any of this, but he got it right. And another point about cement cities and Book of Mormon geography is that we do have cities of cement, El Mirador among them, in Mesoamerica and Central America. Nothing like that in North America. You just don't find cement cities in North America, showing that the geography of North America, for a number of reasons, including lack of cement cities, just does not fit with the actual text of the Book of Mormon. One other comment here, and that is that Bruce has talked before about chapter 3, verse 14, and records, and not a hundredth part's been written. Verse 15 talks about many, many books and records of every kind have been kept chiefly by the Nephites. And then the question becomes, well, where are all of these records? And the answer is that probably there are some left that have not been found. But when the Spaniards came over, they melted the records that were made out of gold into ingots and other usable shapes and took them back to Spain. And the other records that were made on vellum, animal skin, and on the equivalent of papyrus, although it wasn't the same plant, you know, the paper-based records, those were all burned up. The Spaniards literally destroyed virtually all of the records of the Central American natives. And that's a tragedy. There have been a few records, a few codices from Native Americans that have survived those are in the form of carvings on temples, but there are a few codices that have found their way into places like the Vatican Library and a few others, but they are few and far between. So that's what happened to most of the records and why there are very few available. And with that, I guess the only other comment I have about Chapter 3 is that we are now somewhere in the vicinity of 40 to 45 BC. And Bruce mentioned earlier BCE. For those who are uninitiated in the terminology here, BC traditionally meant before the time of Christ or before Christ. But a lot of scholars don't like referencing all the time frames with something that's attached to Christianity. And so they say BCE, before the Common Era, or after the Common Era, depending on the terminology that's being used. And so that's what BCE would be. So here we have in Chapter 3, before the time of Christ, in verse 26, the statement that it came to pass that the work of the Lord did prosper unto the baptizing and uniting to the church of God many souls, yea, even tens of thousands. And in verse 28, it says, and we see that the gate of heaven is open to all, even to those who will believe on the name of Jesus Christ, who is the Son of God. I've mentioned this before in other roundtables and in other contexts, that there are those who criticize the Book of Mormon, saying it's an anomaly before the time of Christ to talk about baptism and to talk about Jesus Christ. It may very well be that if we had the original documents from which Joseph Smith translated this, that it would say something along the lines of, there was a mikveh, there was a ritual cleansing in verse 26, which would be the Jewish way of saying it. And many people joined the synagogue or the church of God, however you would like to describe it. And in verse 28, it might very well have said that heaven is open to all those who will believe on the Savior. After all, the word Jesus is derived in English from the Hebrew word for Savior, and Christ is derived from the Greek word that means Savior or anointed one. And so when you get right down to it, it's all the same. And Joseph Smith's translation really is accurate and correct, because for us, this was baptism. People were being immersed in water, they were being cleansed and brought out of the water clean. And why did they do it? They did it to believe on the Messiah, Jesus Christ, and to join his church. So don't let details that some claim are anachronisms bother you, because when you get right down to it, a translation is best when it conveys the meaning of the underlying words the very best to the reader. And I believe Joseph Smith has done that here. Back to you.
Okay. Well, by the way, one other thing on the destruction of records. I mean, everything Martin said is great, and it was a tremendous tragedy, because the Spaniards really did destroy almost everything that was there. And the tragedy being that Mesoamerica was the one area that actually had literacy in pre-Columbian America. It was the only place where there was a written language, and almost everything that was written down was destroyed. But it's also worth noting that Enos pointed out all the way back around, you know, 500 something BC, that the Lamanites swore they would destroy the records of the Nephites. And in fact, archaeology among the Mesoamerican, the different Mesoamerican cultures show that this was often practiced, that when someone new came to power, and particularly if they were from a different ethnic or cultural center, they would start effacing periods and sculptures and, you know, basically destroying them to remove the names of those of the other culture who had lived before. And this was a well-attested practice in the ancient Near East as well. You saw it a lot among the Egyptians, where you'd have a new dynasty come to power and they'd basically go through and wipe out all the monuments to the pharaoh or lineage of pharaohs that had fallen out of favor. Chapter 4, we start to see things fall apart after this big burst of prosperity with, you know, some energy and some confusion. Chapter 4, it gets right to the point that Mormon says it was because of the pride in their hearts, the meaning among the Nephites, and especially among the members of the church, that caused this great dissension. Members of the church did repent, but the Lamanites came down and basically pushed the Nephites all the way out of the land of Zarahemla up into Bountiful. And Moroni-ha tried to retake lands, but it could only retake half of the lands. And the interesting thing is at the very end, it says that the Nephites saw that they had become weak like unto their brethren the Lamanites, and the Spirit of the Lord did no more preserve them, for they had fallen into a state of unbelief and awful wickedness. And they saw that the Lamanites were exceedingly more numerous than they, and except they should cleave unto the Lord their God, they must unavoidably perish. So the Nephites had always seemed to have this fighting advantage over the Lamanites, and suddenly it's gone. And they recognize, hey, you know, the Lamanites are exceedingly more numerous than us, and that's a constant theme, really, all the way back to the times of King Benjamin. And they suddenly realize if we're not getting help from the Lord, they can just sort of wipe us out. And this is I think it may use the word precarious here, maybe in one of the other chapters. Basically, the Nephites are looking at conquest and destruction at this point. That the dissenters who keep stirring up the Lamanites to battle may finally get their way and take over all of they've already taken over half of the Zarahemla Basin, and they may take it all over for good.
Great comments. Thanks, Bruce. What is it that is the difference in the way the Nephites are and have been in the past? And why would that difference make them less powerful in matters of war? We have a clue to that if we go back a few chapters to Alma chapter 43, verse 9, where it talks about the emergence of Moroni as a general and how he motivates his troops and why the Nephites win the battles. Verse 9 of chapter 43 says that the design of the Nephites was to support their lands and their houses, their wives, their children, to preserve their rights and privileges, their liberty, and their ability to worship God according to their desires. And that's reiterated again in verse 47. And right in the midst of one of the battles, the Nephites seem to start to shrink back and not be willing to fight hard. And Moroni perceives this and inspires their hearts with those thoughts again of home, family, liberty, God, freedom, and goodness. And of course, those are the great motivators without those things, which are not self-centered. Those are things that are based in service to others and in focus on God. And those are the great motivators. When one loses those, one finds oneself self-centered and often afraid, because the only thing left to lose is yourself, and you don't care about others. And so I think that's the core of why the Nephites are in such a bad position. They've lost their faith, and the serious side effect of that is their motivation to do really, really well for their whole society and their families is gone. It's lost, or at the very least, it's diminished. And because of that, they can't fight as well, which is quite tragic. And so, I think that's the key to what's really going on here. One of the most important parts of the description here is that Zarahemla falls again. And this has happened before. We saw this just a few chapters earlier in chapter 1, verses 22 and 27. And we have here in verse 11 this great statement that says, "Now this great loss of the Nephites and the great slaughter which was among them would not have happened had it not been for their wickedness and their abominations which were among them, yea, and it was among those also who professed to belong to the church of God." And so, as Bruce mentioned earlier, they've lost something serious here, and even church members have lost it. This isn't just for the atheists and the agnostics among them. Somehow this has crept into the church as well. And that is indeed a very, very ominous sign. Back to you.
Yeah, verse 23. And that's my last comment in this chapter. Verse 23 has always been very powerful. It says, "And because of their iniquity, the church had begun to dwindle, and they began to disbelieve in the spirit of prophecy and in the spirit of revelation, and the judgments of God did stare them in the face." That's such a powerfully evocative phrase. You know, it's easy to sort of mentally put off and say, "Oh, this is going to be fine. We can work this out, and we can do this. We can get around this." But now they've reached a point where, as Martin says, if even in the church, their faith has begun to dwindle, and they realize they may be on the verge of extinction as a civilization. That you know, all the things they have put off or have excused for so long may come due.
This is foreshadowing one of the things. Let's try again, see if I can get a little better. All right. Okay, well, we'll just do with the funny little label here. One of the most important things here about this is that it's something that can happen to any group of people. We see, as part of the events here in the Book of Mormon, that a whole civilization can be lost, and a whole civilization can be lost because faith is lost. And that's happened many times before in history. One of the other things that's important to notice here is that this is a continuation of the chapters that we went through in the last few lessons that has wars of the people, Nephites against Lamanites. And the question is often asked, why do you have all these war descriptions in the Book of Mormon? This is supposed to be a spiritual book. Why war after war after war? Why these horrible graphic descriptions? Have a guy who got skewered to his heart so that he couldn't even groan as he fell to the earth. You know, why do we need descriptions like that? I've heard people say, if you made the Book of Mormon into a movie, the Mormons couldn't see it because it'd probably be rated R for violence. Well, it would absolutely be rated R for violence if you showed all the gory details, but so would World War II and World War I and all the other just wars in history, because war is not pretty. And war is thankfully something that has at least recently been absent in the United States and Europe, although we're seeing a resurgence of it with Muslim extremism, but that's a topic for another time. But the point is that the fact that we even ask the question about why are there so many wars described says something about how wonderful the society is in which we live, because we don't have war as part of our lives. For the vast majority of human history, presumably as part of the notion that we all believe in, that there must needs be opposition in all things, wars have been a major part of society and of the human condition. And as such, I for one would be suspect of the Book of Mormon if we had this 1,000-year history and there were no wars. That to me would be unbelievable. The descriptions that we do have in here are very, very believable. Back to you, Bruce.
Well, moving on to chapter 5 here, we see things continuing to sort of decline. Nephi says he yields up the judgment seat to a man whose name was Azoram. And the verses that follow that, it's not clear if Nephi was actually voted out of office, which would have been a first, or if things simply got bad enough that he chose to step down, much as Mormon chose to stop leading the Nephites in battle because of their wickedness. It says in verse 3 that the Nephites were a stiff-necked people, in so much they could not be governed by the law nor justice, save it were to their destruction. And it came to pass Nephi had become weary of their iniquity because of their iniquity, and he yielded up the judgment seat, and he decides to preach. And then we get this beautiful passage, remembering the words which their father, Helaman, had spoken to Nephi and his brother Lehi, culminating in the well-known verse. I can remember the first time I think I heard Truman Madsen quote this verse, and I was still pretty young, meaning probably college age, had not really focused on it, and it had a tremendous impact on me. And it's probably one of the ones that gets quoted most from the Book of Mormon, Helaman 5:12, because I think this is the core message that Mormon is trying to get across, both collectively as a people, but particularly how to hold true in difficult times, because that's what Nephi and Lehi are going through here. Their own civilization has become corrupt and weak, as much as the Lamanites. And you have Helaman telling them, now, my sons, remember that it is upon the rock of our Redeemer, who is Christ, the Son of God, that you must build your foundation. That when the devil shall send forth his mighty winds, yea, his shafts in the whirlwind, Yea, when all his hail and his mighty storm shall beat upon you, it shall have no power over you to drag you down to the gulf of misery and endless woe, because of the rock upon which ye are built, which is a sure foundation, a foundation whereon, if men build, they cannot fall. That to me is probably one of the major themes of the entire Book of Mormon. Because what we see is individual righteousness in the midst of cultural wickedness and upheaval. And in the end, for all that the church can do, for all that a righteous country can do, in the end, it is our individual responsibility to be founded upon the rock of Christ and to look to him for our salvation that gets us through the storm that Helaman's describing here.
Thanks, Bruce. Just a few final comments from my perspective here, and then I'm done. One of these is that after the event that Bruce has mentioned here, this beautiful language in verse 12 of Helaman 5 concludes, we have an event here where Nephi and Lehi are captured. They're taken in verse 21 by an army of the Lamanites, and they're cast into prison for many days. They have no food, and they're taken to be slain. And what happens here is that Nephi and Lehi in verse 23 are encircled about as if by fire, and no one dared put their hands upon them. And this harkens back to the Abinadi experience, where he told wicked King Noah and those around him not to touch him because he hadn't delivered his message yet. And then after that, they could do with him what they wanted to. But here you have a situation where everyone sees them. It says, doesn't say they're encircled about by fire. It says as if by fire. Now, I have personally interviewed and actually counted this up a few months ago just to see. A little over 430 people who have had near-death experiences. And one of the common elements that they describe, not always, but many times, is something similar to what Joseph Smith described and what's being described here in the Book of Mormon. And that is that deity can influence people. And the influence, the direct influence of deity and of heaven upon people is often demonstrated by great, great light. Your descriptions of prophets. Moses was said to shine when he came off from Mount Sinai. Joseph Smith saw the Father and the Son come down to him from heaven. And his description was that they were so bright, he was afraid that the trees and the forest and he himself would be burned up, would be consumed. Those are the kinds of descriptions that we see. And there are many, many others like that. And that's the experience that Nephi and Lehi had here. They were in the midst of the fire. Verse 24, it burned them not, and their hearts did take courage. And so we see here that when all else fails, when needed at appropriate times, heaven can intervene on behalf of the righteous for righteous purpose. And I find that very, very comforting. And you have this beautiful description of the voice that they heard in verse 30. It was not a voice of thunder, nor a voice of great tumultuous noise, but it was a still voice of perfect mildness, as if it had been a whisper, and it did pierce even to the very core, as one would expect when deity communicates. So I love these verses because they ring true to me based on all the people who I have interviewed and the experiences that they have had that are analogous. And with that brief comment, I'll turn it back to Bruce.
Just one more interesting point, and I'm sure that Mormon had this very much in mind in crafting this chapter. Nephi and Lehi, by risking themselves and preaching the gospel, accomplished what Moroni and the Nephite armies were unable to. They not only convert directly about 300 Lamanites, and indirectly, what it says, the more part of the Lamanites were converted, but the Lamanites then turn around and yield up the rest of the lands that they had taken from the Nephites back to the Nephites. So we're sort of at the status quo ante, the way things were before the chapter started. The Nephites now have their lands back. There is tremendous presence of the church among Lamanites. I'm not going to steal the thunder as to what happens in the next set of chapters, but things are sort of turning on their head here from the typical stereotype of the Nephites versus Lamanites. And it ties in again with a comment made elsewhere in the Book of Mormon that the preaching of the word had more effect to change people's minds and hearts than anything else. And we see that again here at the end of chapter 5.
And with that, I think we'll conclude. Thank you for joining us with this interpreter roundtable. We hope you will join us for other roundtables and spend some time on the Interpreter Foundation webpage. There are some wonderful, wonderful offerings there, some great publications and other things. Bruce, thank you for being part of the roundtable tonight, and thank you all for joining us.